It is the first day of the week, and it's still dark as I go to the tomb. You think I would be afraid wandering the streets by myself, but I'm not afraid. I was going with some other women, but I've sped ahead because I just need to be alone. My thoughts are all in a jumble, in a way that they haven't been for a long time. When I was younger, I was unwell, really unwell in my mind. I'd watch the birds as they would flap in the sky, and I'd hear them chattering, this racket at the end of the day as they came and made their home among the trees. And that's what it felt like. It felt like I had bits of thought or bits of feeling kind of flapping away in my head, darting this way and that. And I would find myself ruminating on these bits until I like lost sight of everything else. Sometimes I'd want to like just curl up in my room and just stay there all day and never leave. And then there were other days when I would take to the hills and I'd wander the countryside. People didn't know what to do with me, how to help me. They called me erratic. And I didn't know what to do with me either. I had these thoughts that I didn't really want, and I felt just so alone in these thoughts, abandoned. There's this psalm we'd sometimes sing in the synagogue that says, "My God is my refuge, my ever-present help in times of trouble, my fortress." And I try to pray that, but even praying was so difficult. Like my prayers had become a jumble in my head. And it wasn't just my thoughts. I was distressed when I looked at what was happening in the world around me, when I saw the Romans occupying our land and how cruel they could be, how random in their cruelty they could be. I was wondering where God was. It felt like that perhaps God was abandoning us, like that bit by bit God was kind of removing his presence from us. And I found it really hard to discern what God was doing. We started to hear about this new teacher wandering the countryside. Maybe he was even a prophet, Jesus. And there was one day when he actually came and visited my town. I remember it was a warm day when he came. And he was speaking about God being near. He said, "The kingdom of God is near." I never heard anyone talk about God in that way. And it wasn't just his talk. Like, he just had time for everybody. And when he listened to you, he really listened. And it was like my thoughts could land in his hand, like my thoughts could flutter there like a bird, and he took my thoughts with such care, with such gentleness, and he blessed them. And it was like my mind began to grow quiet, like I became fortified, all the thoughts kind of slotting together, good thoughts returning, like all the pieces having their place. I felt loved. And so I became his disciple along with many other women and men. We started to follow him because there was nobody else like him, nobody else who had this closeness with God. And so I wanted to be close too. It was Jesus who actually gave me the nickname Magdalene. It means tower. I laughed when he told me, I'm like a crooked tower, a tower that collapses, a tower in ruins. He laughed back. He said, "No, like a strong tower. God is going to build you into a strong tower." It was the most unlikely of nicknames, but it stuck. I remember once actually seeing a tower under construction near the Sea of Galilee. They were building this tower so that this town could become like a coastal hub, a fishing hub. But for years, it was just a complete mess. It was just like chaos and dust and construction going on. I thought it would never end. But there did come a time when the tower was completed, and they actually put a light up in the tower so that at night, fishermen could see and find their way home. I thought, could that be me? Could I actually be a strong and great tower, a beacon in the darkness? With Jesus, I found a community that I could belong to. I found a purpose. I mean, some people disapproved. Others just said it was, you know, typical Mary erratic. But I had money, like a significant amount of money, which makes me strange. Women don't generally have money. It's normally, you know, up to their husbands or their fathers to take care of them. And some people say, like, women can't be trusted with money, which of course is nonsense, because there are women who do manage their money and are fine, like my friend Joanna. Joanna comes from one of the more noble, wealthier landowning families. And actually, it's really common in the Galilean countryside for those large families to invest in the Pharisees. They're concerned that bit by bit we are losing our identity, that we're losing who we are as a people, that we're losing sight of God. And so they spend their resources on people who seem to take their faith really seriously. So I gather women like Joanna, women I know, women I don't know, and I say, like, let's pull our strengths together. Let's invest in Jesus. Jesus is worth supporting. There's something different about him. And of course, they don't need much convincing, especially not once they meet Jesus. And they too often are changed, experience healing. It feels like all the bits coming together. It feels like when I'm with Jesus, I'm strong. Like I really am this tower, this beacon in the darkness. And then my brother dies, Lazarus. And Jesus is missing. He's not there. And it's like all those old thoughts of abandonment come back, and I start ruminating on, like, where is he? Like, we sent him a message. We gave him plenty of time. We told him how serious it was. And I was waiting and waiting and waiting, and he just never showed up. I mean, who does that? It's like 4 days later, after Lazarus' death, that Jesus eventually showed. And he wanted to be taken to the burial place. And so I took him, and he reached the tomb and he started to cry. And I kind of like turned away from him. I didn't want to see. He started shouting for them to roll back the stone, and then he started shouting for Lazarus to come out. And the next thing, when I looked, I saw like Lazarus kind of stumbling out into the light, still wrapped in the strips of linen that we had wrapped him in. We started to call Jesus the resurrection and the life, our refuge, our ever-present help in times of trouble, the Son of God. We had this big celebration afterwards, lots of food and drink. And during the meal, I poured perfume all over Jesus' feet, which the disciples again labeled me as erratic for doing that. But I wanted to show Jesus how much I loved him. Like, I could see how much he loved us. And I could also see that, I don't know, he was down, or he was troubled in some way. I wondered what birds flapped in his head. He kept talking about death. He kept talking about his own death. And I knew the authorities were unhappy. They didn't know what to do with Jesus. I knew that there was like plots maybe to take him, maybe arrest him. But I also knew that the crowds loved him. And I thought that would be enough. The crowds love him. I love him. That will be enough. When we entered into Jerusalem, I thought all the bits were kind of coming together. The crowds welcomed him, declared him to be our king. But in just a few days, it all kind of collapsed. It became this jumble. And there I stood with the other women, with Jesus' own mother, watching as they crucified him. I remember it was really hot. And the men had fled. It was just us. And we were trying to be present. It felt really important just to be present, to bear witness to what was happening as they mutilated him. I don't know how else to describe it. We stood at the foot of the cross and there were these birds, like real birds, flapping around, kind of circling, waiting to see whether he was dead or not. I had to kind of like flap them away. I'd never seen crucifixion up close before, and it was the most gut-wrenching thing I had ever seen. And I stood there trying to be a strong tower, thinking like maybe if I just stand here, like that will give Jesus some strength, some comfort. And there was like bits of prayer kind of flapping away in my head, like praying to God, for God to do something, to stop this, to end the suffering, for God to strike down the soldiers who are like fighting over his clothes, for God to make those crowds go away. But in the late afternoon, one of the soldiers checked to see if Jesus was dead, and so they stabbed him with a spear in his side and declared him dead. And that was it. I think I'd been waiting, you know, for something to happen, for something to change. Instead, all the like normal procedures kind of kicked into place. They took down his body. Nicodemus came and he kind of ensured that it was wrapped up in strips of linen and spices and placed in a tomb actually quite close to where he'd been crucified. And evening came and everyone went home. I couldn't sleep that night. My mind keep searching for the one I love. I keep thinking of Jesus alone in that tomb, in that darkness, and I wonder if he feels abandoned. I keep ruminating on everything I saw and his words, his last words, I don't understand them. He said, "It is finished." What is finished? All the good he has done, that is finished. All the healing, all the transformation of lives, that's finished. He's finished. God is finished. Am I finished? Still, on the first day of the week, while it is dark, I go to the tomb. I go through the streets and squares, searching for the one my heart loves, and I think back to that old song that speaks about love being mightier than death. A love like a flame that cannot be quenched, like waters trying to go over it and being able to unquench it. What type of love is this? I'm searching and searching for a love that endures. Really, it should be our close relatives who go to the tomb, who keep vigil, who tend. But I don't care. I am empty. I'm empty of all fear. I'm empty of doing what you're supposed to do. I'm empty of everything except love. But when I reach the tomb, I know immediately that something's not right. Something is wrong. The stone has been rolled back. It doesn't make any sense. I'm like, Why is the stone rolled back? Has someone stolen the body already? I mean, it's just been a few days. Maybe one of the disciples have relocated it, has moved it, and maybe no one told me. My mind is a jumble, it's a racket in my head as I run back to the city looking for some explanation, something that would just make sense of this tomb. I run back, and by the time I get to the disciples, I'm almost hysterical. Like I'm struggling to breathe, and as I say, they've taken his body. They've taken the Lord's body, and we don't know where they have placed it. But they don't know it either. That sends them into a flurry, and Peter runs off, and another disciple follows him, and they go to see the tomb. And I follow behind, but a lot slower, kind of limping. It's morning now, the sun is fully up, it's a beautiful morning. The birds are flapping in the air. By the time I reach the tomb, I don't know, the disciples are not there, that they've fled. So it's just me standing there again, alone in front of this tomb. And this time I just start crying. wailing, really, my whole body heaving, because I thought I was a bit who'd found something that made sense of it all. I thought I was going to be part of something that was good and strong and loving, that was going to change the world. And then they crucified him. And now not only have they crucified him, but his body is gone. Like how cruel can people be? Eventually, I kind of bend down and I make my way into the tomb. I crawl in and it's really dark at first. But then I see that there's two angels sitting inside the tomb dressed in yellow and white. And they turn to me and their faces are almost like expressionless. And I see these strips of linen which had wrapped Jesus' body and just lying there on the ground. And one angel kind of sits where Jesus' head would have been, and another angel kind of sits at the end where his feet would have been. And in unison, they turn and they say, "Why are you crying?" I don't know. I might have mumbled a reply, but I kind of like stumble out of there because it doesn't make sense. I've heard about angels. I've heard the stories. I hear them described as being messengers of God. Sometimes angels appear kind of to make God's presence visible. But how can God be in this tomb? How can God be here in this place of death? It doesn't make sense. It's like God is here but not here. I go out of the tomb and I almost like bump immediately into a stranger. And he asks me the same question that the angels has asked me. He says, "Woman, why are you weeping? Who is it that you're looking for?" And I assume he must be like, I don't know, the gardener or something, someone responsible for this place. And so like in desperation, I kind of like clutch him. I'm like thinking maybe he has the answer. I say, "Sir, if you've moved the body, like let me know so I can go and I'll take care of it." And he says, "Mary, just my name, but I know that voice." I brush away my tears and I say, "Rabbi?" And then I kind of fling my arms around Jesus and hold on as tight as possible. And eventually he like gently unwinds me from him. And he says, "Don't hold on to me too tightly. I am ascending to my Father. Go and tell the others, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Don't really understand, but I do as he says. I start walking away and then I stop and I look and he's still there. He's still standing in the garden kind of waving me off. I go to the disciples and I tell them what I've seen. Some believe me, others think it's Mary being erratic again. I've been trying to put all the pieces together, trying to make sense of it all. He says he's going, and it feels like an abandonment all over again, but it's not, it's different, it's an absence. He's telling me that things aren't going to be the same. In fact, now that I think about it, Jesus has been saying this quite a lot in the lead up to this moment. He kept talking about going, and when he goes, he's going to send his Spirit, and the Spirit of God's going to be with us, bringing comfort, being an ever-present help in times of trouble, being our refuge, helping us to declare that God is near. I've been thinking a lot about absence and presence. There's comfort in knowing that death is not the end, that I will see Jesus again. There's comfort in knowing that the Spirit of God is with me now. I still miss him though. But maybe the missing, maybe the loss, has given me this great compassion for those around me who are feeling alone and abandoned too. Maybe I can be to them what Jesus was to me. I can sit with them. I can tell them that God is near. That even when it feels like the world is abandoned, it's not true. God is near and at work. Or maybe sometimes I can just sit and be present with someone and we can just sit there together and discover God is there. I don't know, you might think I'm crazy. You wouldn't be the first. Some say, why listen to her? I had 7 devils in me. I was a whore. I was like secretly perfuming my body and engaging in indecent acts. Some say, well, I listened to her, she was deluded, crazy, engaged in sorcery, and that's why she saw Jesus risen. Some say, I'm a dangerous woman. Don't let her speak too much because she might give other women ideas. Look what freedom she had. Even the disciples, the closest disciples, sometimes wish that the story had gone a little bit differently. They say, why was Mary the first one to see the empty tomb? Why was Mary the first one to see the risen Jesus? It just complicates things. Because she loved him too much and Jesus loved her, and this will confuse people. Let's let Peter speak instead. I mean, he is the rock on which the church will be built. Let him share the story. But I'm Mary Magdalene, and I tell my story, and there are those who listen, and we kind of laugh and we cry together, and there are those who come to trust that even in the jumble, God is near, that Jesus is alive, and that he is our refuge, our ever-present help in times of trouble, our fortress.
Cynthia Bujold writes, "The risen Lord is indeed risen, present, intimate, creative, closer than your own heartbeat, accessed through your vulnerability, your capacity for intimacy. Christ is with us, and through him you will never be separated from anyone or anything you have ever loved. For love is the ground in which we live and move and have our being." This is the message that Mary Magdalene brings. This is the message we most need to hear. You're invited this morning to write a response to Jesus on a yellow strip of cloth, a word of thanks or praise, a call for him to unjumble what is still needs to be unjumbled. It can be whatever you need to say. Come and place it vertical on the black fabric. Yellow reminds us of the new dawn, of the sun as it peeks over the hills and bathes the world in its warm light. Yellow also reminds us of the angels who blazed in light at the tomb, driving away darkness and death.